Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The episode in which whatever it is that's going on in political Washington is explained by high concept mathematics. Trust me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 7th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I don't want to get all chaos theory on you here, but one way to look at the deal that President Trump made yesterday with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, remember, they are the leaders of the opposition party in the Congress in the United States. One way to look at that thing is as something of a butterfly effect, a seemingly trivial thing that literally changes the future, a la Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, if you happen to have seen that one. I say that because as we sit here right now, we've got a bill that's passed the Senate containing the first dose of Hurricane Harvey money, but that also happens to fund the government for the next 3 months and raises the debt limit to boot, those last two of which were, believe you me, going to suck up a whole lot of energy later this month. Yes, the House does still have to vote on it, but in the meanwhile, congressional Republicans are left trying to figure out what it all means for what they wanted their economic agenda to be. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
A lot of politics is thinking a few steps ahead, which is why Republicans in Congress wanted a longer extension to the debt limit and government funding than the 3 months they got. David Super, a law professor who studies Congress at Georgetown University, explains.
If you pushed the debt limit out 6 months, then the Republicans could try to move a tax bill this fall that increased the deficit and then come around a few months later and say, wow, we've got a big deficit. We have to do something about the debt limit.
The Harvey funding bill was a chance to get all those economic issues off the table long enough to pass tax reform. But not anymore, says David Barker at American University.
Because now they'll be in the midst of negotiating and needing Democrats to continue funding the government at the same time that they're trying to ram through this tax overhaul.
And because the debt limit and government funding have to get done, Democrats will have more leverage to push their own economic priorities in the tax reform debate. Barker says if tax reform gets done this year,
it will more likely have fewer tax cuts. The tax cuts will be less deep. There may be more cutting of loopholes and stuff like that that Democrats want, the Republicans don't necessarily want as much.
Just the kind of conversations you want to have around the holidays. The current bill sets us up to hit the debt ceiling again in December. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Perfect. Just perfect. Wanted. One metropolitan area, North American location required, million-plus population, business-friendly, with strong tech talent, ready to think big when it comes to real estate. That's the basic gist of Amazon's ask for its new second headquarters, the company announced this morning. CEO Jeff Bezos says the new digs will be a full equal to the current setup in Seattle, with as many as 50,000 highly paid workers and $5 billion in new spending. Competition obviously is going to be brisk, but what is up with that one company, two headquarters thing? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explored the pros and cons.
Amazon says its new second headquarters won't be second best or second among equals. It'll be complete, with executives allowed to locate their teams where they want.
It certainly does seem strange.
Management professor Peter Capelli at the Wharton School says there's a reason every major corporation he can think of has just one hub for its senior executives, a central location to make decisions.
The problem is if it's anything that needs to go to headquarters, it's also the kind of thing that you need everybody at the top on the same page with.
On the same page, sure, but in the same room or even the same time zone? Mark Canese teaches entrepreneurship at the University of San Francisco.
Even in the digital age, a physical location still matters. The ability to walk into a conference room and meet with a senior executive is pivotal in getting things done in a timely manner.
On the plus side, Canese says Amazon expands its access to talent. Seattle's already crammed with Amazon, buildings, staff, satellite startups. So David Schick at Consumer Edge Research says a second headquarters may be crucial.
You need diversity of training, backgrounds, and at some point, if a headquarters does have its own gravity and can't bring that in an optimal way, I think it's interesting to explore.
Analyst Tuna Amobi at CFRA Research thinks Amazon's up to this challenge.
Exponential growth, I guess it's really a high-class problem to have.
He says there'll be a future of challenge and opportunity for whichever city hosts Amazon's new headquarters, too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Classes started in the New York City public school system today, and as of this year, all of those kids, 1.1 million of them, are eligible for free lunch. The majority already qualified because of their family's incomes, but now they don't have to do any paperwork to eat, and they don't have to deal with the stigma that free lunch can often bring. And not only that, reports Marketplace's Andy Euler, but the new policy makes economic sense, too.
Ben Kalos grew up on the wealthy Upper East Side and went to the prestigious Bronx High School of Science. But unlike many of his neighbors, money was tight.
Which meant that I was on free or reduced school lunch.
Now, he's a New York City Council member and has been an outspoken proponent of free lunches for all. Because, he says, he remembers his own daily dilemma.
The truth is, I was starving, but I just preferred to go hungry than deal with the pain that came with being made fun of for being lower income than my classmates.
He says New York's program means every student gets the same meal for free. The city shuffled around a little bit of money and got grants from the federal government, making the extra cost minimal. 75% of New York public school kids were already eligible for free or reduced price lunch.
This seems to me one of those things that you justify on a cost benefit.
Amy Ellen Schwartz is an economist at Syracuse. She studies free lunch programs and says the numbers justify them, especially because there won't be any more paperwork or payments to process.
It's going to both change the administrative aspect. You know, there's less gatekeeping, less record keeping, less banking.
She says that's why other big cities like Dallas, Boston, and Chicago have made the transition too. And she says benefits show up in the classroom.
The evidence is coming in that it improves student performance for just not that much money.
That, she says, could mean a smarter American workforce down the road. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Bumpy ride on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I saw a projection for Hurricane Irma today that showed the thing going straight up the Florida Peninsula with hurricane-force winds from the Atlantic to the Gulf Coast. Not good in any way, shape, or form. There are, broadly speaking, two phases to disasters like Harvey and Irma once they hit. There's the immediate response, generally led by FEMA, trying to make sure people are safe and dry and fed. And then, as the waters recede, that response gives way to long-term recovery. Right about now, that means a lot of people in Texas, and in a week or so, this is going to be the case in Florida. A lot of those people are wondering, what happens next? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the long road ahead.
So do you remember what you were doing at this point, like a couple days after Sandy?
Just walking around in circles, not knowing what to do first.
Lisa Stevens is sitting in her light-filled living room, her home on a lagoon on the Jersey Shore flooded during Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Everything had to be replaced.
We didn't know what we were facing and how long the recovery process was going to be.
With construction starts and stops and some work that had to be redone once she learned she needed to elevate her home, it took Stevens until April 2016 to finish her last repairs. It was a crash course in the bureaucracy of disaster recovery. Her advice for Harvey and Irma survivors, document everything.
I've seen people come into programs literally with three-ring binders, and every piece of paper, every receipt, every document is going to be needed for them.
After an event like Harvey, funding for long-term recovery, as opposed to the immediate emergency response, has to come through a special appropriation from Congress, which can sometimes take a while. Then much of the housing money will flow through HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and then into grants to state and local governments. And it's these state and local governments that are responsible for designing and implementing most housing recovery programs. Basically, the money homeowners get after exhausting all other options, like insurance claims. Stan Gamont oversees these grants for HUD.
Most of our grantees do not have a long-term recovery plan of major scope just sitting in their file drawer. In many cases, they have to sort of start from scratch and think about exactly how they will do this locally.
States have to figure out what types of grants to make available, which might mean researching past recovery programs in other states. They have to create a staffing plan, hire contractors, build an IT system.
The outcomes vary. In some places, they are very good outcomes. In some cases, the outcomes are not always what we would hope.
Gamont says to manage programs where a local agency oversees the construction process for a homeowner tend to work better than ones that let people do it themselves. But they can also take longer to set up. Brad Gehr has worked in disaster recovery at FEMA and for the city of New York after 9/11 and Sandy. He says starting from scratch on these plans after each disaster, it's slow and inefficient. Take, for example, setting up the technology to process and manage claims. New York and New Jersey each built their own systems after Sandy.
To create an online portal with a case management system backing it up is really, really expensive. It spends a lot of the money that could otherwise go to the disaster survivors, and it delays the rollout of the program.
Gehr says other holdups, like limited data sharing across agencies, could be addressed before a disaster with some off-the-shelf recovery plans from HUD that states could tweak to their needs.
So all we would ask is, in an off-the-shelf program, resolve all these bureaucratic issues for us, give us the technology, the portal, and the back end that we need, and then give us a few simple programs that we can already just make a few little tweaks to customize it for our particular situation.
Gehr thinks that could get people home faster. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Called my dad, said, "Hey, Dad, will you loan me the money to do the next round?" And he said, "No, but call your brother."
A sibling rivalry that is good for business. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off about a 0.1% today, 22 points, 21,784. NASDAQ picked up less than a 0.1%. That's 4.6397. The S&P 500 basically flat, 2465. Amazon, as we told you earlier, is taking proposals to house their new digs, a second headquarters. One company, two headquarters. Amazon, which now also owns Whole Foods, as you know, rang up 1.2% today. Blue Apron Holdings simmered down 2.3%. Big chemical companies battered by Harvey are trying to help get their Houston employees back on their feet. Occidental Petroleum giving out interest-free loans and grants for repairs, up 0.3% today. ExxonMobil used a fleet of helicopters to deliver water to its workers, up 0.3% as well. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.04%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As Kimberly Adams was telling us up at the top of the program, there are policy machinations aplenty going on in Washington, D.C. right now. Among them, what Congress might or might not be able to get done on DACA. We are going to look at the immigration economy from another angle right now, our food supply and how it would break down without immigrant labor. Marketplace's Rima Kreis took a trip out to small town Nebraska a couple of weeks ago, cattle country, right in the heart of the meat processing and packing industry, a slice of this economy that runs on immigrant labor in a state with one of the tightest labor markets in the country. Here's Rima.
Chuck Fulkin isn't much of a coffee guy. He starts the day with a large mug of orange soda.
Tastes good. Keeps me up. Gets me going.
Gets him going to the feedlot. Fulkin, a big, burly guy with a graying mustache, has been working the family farm since he was a boy.
I am the third generation that's been on this farm. I grew up here and lived here my whole life.
Here is Lee, Nebraska, where there are more cattle than people. Fulkin's 450-acre farm is home to more than 8,000 crossbred heifers and steers. They've been shipped from ranches all over the country for one reason, to be fattened up. Cattle spend about 6 months here, heads down, in the feeding trough. And once they're big enough, they're sent to the slaughterhouse.
Oh, an optimum weight is about 1350.
Anything more? Too much.
Bigger carcass, bigger steaks. Nobody wants a ribeye steak the size of your plate.
Fulkin isn't just feeding cattle. His family farms hundreds of acres of corn and alfalfa to make the feed. The business brings in more than $4 million a year. And to run it, Fulkin needs workers who can wrangle cattle on horseback, spot the early signs of pneumonia, operate heavy machinery.
That tractor right there is a $150,000 tractor, and he's pulling a manure spreader that costs $75,000.
Fulkin has long relied on a group of highly skilled immigrants to help work the farm. Now, he voted for Donald Trump for president.
And I support him strongly, but I disagree with everybody in Washington right now on this immigration policy.
He says states like Nebraska couldn't produce the billions of dollars in food they do now without immigrant labor. And he says
agriculture needs to have a skilled worker status. Maybe it doesn't take college education, but it still takes skill. I think we're being left out and left short.
Without that status, it's harder for ag workers to get priority when it comes to visas. As we talk, Fulkin's crew loads hundreds of cattle onto a semi for the 30-mile trip to the Cargo Meat Processing Plant in Schuyler. The plant turns out nearly a million tons of steak, ribs, burger, and other beef products a year. It's a crucial link in the food supply chain, one that also depends on immigrants, who make up more than a third of meat processing workers in the U.S. When we arrive at Cargill, shifts are changing. Hundreds of workers, many of them from countries like Mexico, Guatemala, and Somalia, move through the metal turnstiles. Some head quickly to a small white trailer, not far from the kill floor and the production line.
So I'm going to read the word. You guys repeat for me, please. Traffic.
Traffic.
Children.
Children.
Bucket.
About 10 workers are sitting in what looks like a kindergarten classroom, right down to the alphabet letters on the wall. They're learning English at Cargill's Community Learning Center. One of the most eager students is 45-year-old Maluka Becker, a refugee from Ethiopia. She's just come off her shift.
My job is tip tail and trimming.
8 hours a day, she's on her feet trimming the tails off cattle. How many?
I don't know, more than 2,000 maybe, 2,500.
When Becker came to this country in 2005, she looked for jobs at Walmart and other retail stores, but no luck. So she went to work at a meat processing plant. Cargill is her third plant job. She makes around $600 a week. Her husband works the night shift at Cargill, and she jokes the only time they see each other is in bed. Still,
Nebraska is good, and we have good life. We work. It's a hard job, but we have good life.
Keeping workers in those hard jobs is one reason Cargill funded the center where Becker is studying English. It also offers GED and citizenship prep courses.
Let's work together to put these in alphabetical order.
But Becker is here because she's set her sights beyond Cargill. She wants to improve her English so she can go back to school and someday get a better job in tech. Away from the kill floor and the smell of blood. In Schuyler, Nebraska, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Rima's back in Schuyler tomorrow with a story about how people like Maluka Becker have turned their jobs at the meatpacking plant into businesses and political influence. In New York City, this is the first day of Fashion Week, traditionally a time for designers to show off their next season's creations. But as with much else in this economy, fashion just ain't what it used to be. There are new rules for how we want to buy our clothes and when we want to buy them. One of the designers in New York this week is Rebecca Minkoff of the high-end Rebecca Minkoff Collection, of which she is the creative director and her brother Uri is the CEO. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
I wonder whether, and you guys are the experts, but with Fashion Week upon us, don't you have better things to do than sit in a radio studio?
We have nothing better than the connected with a customer.
The whole goal this week is leading towards an event that's all about connectivity with our consumer. And so if we're going to reach you by radio, then that's another way to be in touch with her.
Yeah, we actually were the ones that changed Fashion Week. So it used to be about showing season ahead to prospective buyers and press. And what we celebrate Fashion Week today is actually for the consumer in the season that we're launching. So this is actually perfect timing for us.
You guys are jumping way down my list of questions, Uri, but let me ask you about it. Well, no, it's all right. You know, I'll go where the interview takes me. As you said, it used to be that, you know, there was a spring show and you didn't see those clothes till, you know, 6 months later, whatever. Now, though, and Uri, I guess this is what you're saying. The consumer has changed, right? We want it now.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it on social media instantly. Fast fashion has entered the supply chain. And so by the time 6 months later comes, you've seen it 10 times. It's been knocked off nine ways to Sunday. Yeah. And you're just kind of bored with it. So we said, you know what? We're going to show you something for the first time when it's ready and you can buy it. And we're going to surprise and delight you with what that is. And you better rush to go buy it right now because it might sell out.
You two, Rebecca, have been at this for a while in a partnership. Give me the very quick origin story of how this company got started.
The 30-second version is...
Oh, take a minute. Go ahead.
Thank you. Started, had a very small clothing line, decided on a whim to launch a handbag. Daily Candy, the only social media kind of its day, decided to write about the handbag, named it the Morning After Bag. Saw my first, you know, order sell out of a boutique, ran out of money, called my dad, said, hey, Dad, I think I'm finally feeling a taste of some success. Will you loan me the money to do the next round? And he said, no, but call your brother.
Really?
So that's how it happened.
And there I entered.
None of my business, but has it been smooth sibling sailing most of the time?
For the most part, you know, I think we've had a couple conversations early on with our father where he entered the conversation and said, "Now, children, I love you both very much. You know, we're gonna solve this right now." But one of the things that we started a couple years ago is the idea of corporate couples counseling.
Wow!
And so we actually sit down with someone once or twice a year. We usually spend about two full days doing an offsite together, so it kind of keeps us fresh and grounded and keeps the relationship in a good place.
You know, that's interesting, Uri, because you, I mean, you were an entrepreneur. You were a software guy, right?
Yeah, I had a software company for about 10 years. I had no expertise in this space, but I think what's been fascinating is I'm looking at something of how would you build this as a software project? She's looking at it from a fashion designer. And I think we've been able to combine those two to have a very unique approach in the world.
Who's the competition for you guys, Uri?
I mean, look, it's a lifestyle brand, but a predominant amount of our business is done in the handbag category, right? We offer handbags between, you know, $200 and $500. So it's really those other lifestyle brands that are kind of in that space.
What's it like out there right now, Rebecca, for higher-end retail like yourselves? I mean, y'all did okay during the recession and the financial crisis. How are you doing now?
I think we're doing pretty good. I mean, I think what we're witnessing is something I talk about. You know, when the music industry went through its upheaval in 2008, 2009, I think, you know, that conversation is happening in fashion. But I think for us, the key is the tighter the connection we have in our consumer and the more we make traditional brick and mortar retail about experiences, can she come away with something other than the product she bought?
Yeah, I think for us on the business side, we're very focused on who we sell to, making sure that we're with the top tier partners, making sure that, you know, we're selling as much full price as we can and really supporting those that do. What's great is, you know, we have the largest brand in fashion with a female designer who's a millennial. And what we're finding is that customers really responding to Rebecca as a lifestyle brand. So we have huge growth in footwear and in clothing and in other accessories categories. And so we're very optimistic about the future and Rebecca's continued relationship with the customer.
Rebecca, since your brother mentioned it probably half a dozen times in the last 45 seconds, you're it. You're the brand.
Well, I never like to look at it that way because I think one could get quite a big head. I think we still very much have an entrepreneurial spirit. So I think it's always about how can we reach more consumers? How can I tighten the relationship with my customer? How can I inspire to be more fearless just in life? You know, I think there's lots of conversations that exist right now about, you know, women entrepreneurs and breaking the glass ceiling. And it never occurred to me when I started I'm a woman designer, right? I was just a designer. But now I have a duty to inspire more women to reach higher and achieve their goals and really shatter that glass ceiling. So that's, you know, something else that keeps me grounded and excited.
Rebecca Minkoff of the Rebecca Minkoff Collection, her brother and co-founder Uri, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, a little bit of economic pie in the sky. You know that deal between President Trump and congressional Democrats that we started with? Well, there is more. It turns out that at that meeting yesterday morning in the Oval Office, Trump and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, talked about getting rid of the debt limit altogether, just making it go away. Here's what the president said at a photo op this morning.
For many years, people have been talking about getting rid of debt ceiling altogether, and there are a lot of good reasons to do that. So certainly that's something that will be discussed. We even discussed it at the meeting that we had yesterday. It complicates things. It's really not necessary because you're talking about budget, so it's really not necessary. But it's certainly something we could discuss.
It'd save us a whole lot of self-inflicted economic tsuris every 18 months or so, that is for sure. But it would be such a tough vote for a whole lot of people in Congress. All right, we got to go. A whole lot of nothing in equities today, a 10% either way. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, he's back from vacation, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.